You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 52 of Tea Break Archaeology. My name is Mathilde Siebrecht and this is part two of our Tea Break with Jessica von Lom talking all about knitting. So welcome back, Jess. I hope you had a lovely pause in between these episodes. I mean,
I certainly did.
Like, what, a minute?
Yeah, we had a nice little chat in the background.
We did. Talking about all sorts of things. So there you go. And I learned I learned that crochet, unfortunately, takes up, what did you say? 1.5 times more yarn than knitting does?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I may have to just suck it up and try knitting again. And then I'm less expensive with my yarn consumption.
Or I'll just have to come to Germany and then you can try knitting again and then you have a supervisor.
That would be wonderful. Let's do that. Yeah. You can use that as your excuse for coming over and visiting me.
Is that a tax write-off then? Is that professional work?
Right.
I think so. You can do it. We can do the use wear analysis.
Yes. There you go.
Research. Sorted. Yes.
Done.
Perfect. Excellent.
We're done. Sorted. If anyone was wondering what on earth we're talking about, by the way, make sure to listen into our last episode where you will hear about our basic proposal for doing a knitting usewear experiment.
That's one of my new favorite words.
Right. I'm not sure what I was trying to combine there in terms of words, but
I like it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So last time we talked a little bit about the kind of the physical evidence for knitting, the sort of historic evidence for knitting. But how about in sort of more recent times? And I mean, both of us, as we mentioned in the last episode, are very much kind of prehistory, more focused, shall we say, than kind of historic. But if knitting is something that I think has really made a comeback, I don't know. It seems that I have so many friends now who are really into knitting. It seems to have really become a sort of popular thing for like young people to do again.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the pandemic. I mean, people are just stuck indoors. And you were just telling me about a knee surgery you recently had and you were stuck on the couch, so you took up crochet because what else was there to do? But I think like a lot of things with our society currently, or at least with like millennials or Gen Z, like the sort of younger generations, is that trying to like participate in activities that are relaxing, good for you, they're not scrolling on your phone, they're not detrimental to your health, particularly. I mean, sometimes I've overknit and hurt myself, but yeah, it's sort of those like more mindful practices.
Yeah.
And then also being conscious of the environment. And so making do, reuse, that kind of mentality is coming back.
Yeah.
And like slow fashion. So creating your own slow fashion. So yeah, I think it is coming back and I am excited about it.
And you have more sort of autonomy. I've recently been really into watching The Great British Sewing Bee, which is it's on BBC iPlayer, which I've now finally got access to, which I'm very happy about. So I've been catching up on all of my British TV shows because I can't access most of them while I'm here in Germany. But so now I have access to them again and I've been catching up. And it's so amazing I love sewing and I do lots of different sewing, but I make like things. I don't make clothes or if I do make clothes, then I'll basically take something that I already have and just look at how it was made and kind of copy that. But seeing these people come up with all these really interesting, exciting patterns and designs and everything. And I think that's something with knitting as well. Like it's sort of, you can really use your imagination as well. It's something that really creative, but practical, which is like a really nice combination.
Yeah. And I think with like knitting, crochet, those kind of handcrafts, they're very transportable. So you're not locked into place. Whereas with like machine sewing specifically, like you're stuck at your machine and it's going, which can get a little much sometimes, whereas like a little light clicky clack of a knitting needle is, you know, nice and soothing. And you know, crochet basically doesn't sound like anything, which is also nice.
And you can sort of do it in like small bursts. Like you can just do it for like 5 to 10 minutes while you're in the waiting room and then shove it back in your bag and go to your appointment and then do it on the bus. And then like it's sort of very...
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. My sister takes her knitting on the train to...
Excellent pronunciation.
Thank you. Yes. You can tell my Dutch roots, only how I pronounce G's in Dutch.
Which I think is sort of, and it's nice because I guess that's also one of these, like going back to traditions and kind of technological traditions and really focusing on how we make things and why we make things. I mean, that's also one of the reasons why I wanted to kind of change the direction a bit of this podcast, is to really focus on, okay, but why do we have all of the things that we have around the house? Like, what is the origins of them? Why are they important? Why are they significant? And like, how can we kind of respect the traditions still in the modern day while kind of living in the modern world? So I think that knitting's a really nice example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And would you say, so, I mean, because when I used to think of knitting, I would always think of like my grandma, you know, because she was very good at knitting and she used to knit things. My mum could knit a little bit. She started knitting me a jumper when I was 6. And I think last year she finally admitted defeat and unpicked it all and made it into a jumper for my dad instead, because she's just every year she was like, right, I really need to finish that jumper this year. And obviously I have developed physically somewhat in between the ages of 6 and 33. So
what? That's crazy.
Right? Weird. That was very mature for a 6-year-old. But yeah, so, but like, I think that was always a little bit of a image in the mind. When you thought of knitting, you thought of like a grandma sitting in the rocking chair knitting. Was that sort of the tradition, that it would kind of be something that it was more the, I mean, you talked a little bit last episode about the knitting machines coming in, but was it something that was traditionally kind of a older person's craft, shall we say, or did everyone do it, or how has that changed?
Well, so I'm going to answer this question in two different ways.
That's
one way is that
it's like a choose your own adventure.
Choose which, you know, soapbox to stand on.
You want.
So yeah. I think so. Knitting definitely is one of these like granny hobbies that people are talking about. And, you know, same with crochet, embroidery, cross stitch, you know, you name it, picture grandmother doing it. That's the craft.
Granny hobby.
And unfortunately, I think that has led to a lot of like ageist sentiments that people just don't really think about. So like when I go into a yarn store that I've never been to, if there are older women there, and it's typically women, I say women, but occasionally I will see men knitting. It is not as common. I wish more men knit. But so for the purposes of this, if I say women, it's just easier. Anyway, they often look at me as if I must have no idea what I'm doing. And so sometimes I judge a knitting store, like a yarn store, on whether or not they trust that I know how to knit or not based on my appearance. And I'm like, ah, you're jaded. You are not. I like you. This is great. Because like I look young. I'm a millennial, so we don't age. And
just internally.
We are ourselves 80, but our skin looks like a 25-year-old. And so people look and say like, oh, are you new to knitting? And it's like, no, I've been doing this for 28 years. And they're like, oh, I only learned a few years ago. And I'm like, yeah, I know. It's weird, but like, don't judge a book by its cover kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of sad that we've like classified these things as like granny hobbies. Not that like grandmothers are incapable of doing things, but it's just that it's such a small demographic compared to who actually practices the craft and like who, and it sort of reduces the skill and the time and the patience it takes to learn these crafts and to master them. So it, I don't know, I get a little weird about the, like the granny craft label, because I think it's reductive. But so that's my first soapbox.
Okay.
And then the second soapbox.
Yeah, let me pass it.
Is
the second one. Yeah.
So, I mean, because we don't really know how knitting started, we don't really know how the industry, like how it as a hobby or as an industry developed other than its expansion into Europe. So the theories are that it started in the Middle East, but arguably the conditions in the Middle East are better for preserving the organic materials
preservation
that knit garments are made out of.
So they could be elsewhere, we just haven't found the remains.
Exactly. Yeah. And so did it come from there? Did it come from somewhere else? We have no idea, but that's the evidence we have. And so when it moved into Europe, it seemed like kind of the, I would assume, like upper echelon women's leisure hobby, like a pastime. So like, yes, they're making garments for themselves, like stockings and things or gloves.
Yeah.
But who else in the society had time to do that other than upper class women?
Upper class women. Yeah.
And then with the Madonna, the knitting Madonna paintings, that's clearly like indicating women are doing this. But then with the invention of the knitting machine, I finally found my note. It is 1589. Was the invention of the knitting machine.
Okay.
It became more of an industry. It was like a mass produced thing, which obviously men were like, ha, yes.
Now it's my turn.
Mine now.
Yes. Yeah.
And it sort of stayed a men's craft for a long time after that, because like, you know, you think about the classic fisherman sweater with the cables and everything. Those were knit by the men, not necessarily by their wives or their women folk. And because they were, you know, making their own nets and tying ship knots and stuff. So why wouldn't they be able to knit?
Well, that's like actually the needle study that I did for my research thing, because it was sort of assumed that, yes, okay, the women were the main ones who were creating the clothing, and that was like a really essential part. So it shows the sort of importance of women within the society. But for example, if the men were going out on hunting trips, they needed to be able to repair their clothing, because otherwise they would die. It was the Arctic, you know, like if they're like these particularly cold conditions, they were very well equipped to deal with them, but only if they had clothing that was actually working. And if they got a rip or a tear, or if something happened, they would have to be able to sew it themselves as well, which I always found quite interesting.
Yeah. I feel like today it's like, I mean, I cannot tell you how many ex-boyfriends I've had that are like, a button fell off my shirt, can you fix it? And I'm like, oh my God, come on, you're an adult male. What are you doing? Come
on, you can sew a button. Ancestors would be able to do this.
So I think with like a lot of the like industrial revolution, like men were just, you know, getting like keeping a lot of these like traditional crafts, like even tailoring was a men's profession. And then with the onset of like World War I, World War II, men are off fighting, women are back at home, they're the ones in the factories. Women and children specifically were like in the big weaving, like textile factories and things like that. And so I think it started moving back into like women's work with the World War specifically, especially with like World War II, when like, or actually both World Wars, like knitting for the troops and like doing your part for the war effort and that kind of thing.
And it's interesting as well, because knitting is one of those things that's sort of always classified as a craft. This is also something, as when you were talking about that before as well, in terms of granny craft, quotation marks, as well. And I remember, what was it I was looking at? It was something, and they were talking about, well, I had to do a lot of research on that as well, the difference between art and craft, you know, because both have such different connotations. And there was all these comments about like, oh, well, if women do it, then it's craft. But, you know, if upper class men do it, then it's art, you know, and all of this kind of stuff. So it's sort of, when knitting is used in artworks, how is that different? And it was really, oh, I remember now, it was an episode of the Museum of Curiosity, the podcast, and I can't remember for the life of me who the guest was that came on, but he's basically a professional artist and he specializes in knitted exhibitions and stuff. But was talking about that, and he was saying like, it's ridiculous that it's not taken seriously as art because it's considered a craft, but also B, the fact that it's called, oh, it's only a craft, like, is also, you know, it's a skilled process and all of this kind of, I don't know, I find that really fascinating, the classifications that we make about these different crafts.
Well, and it's that same sort of like I don't know, it's like diminishing the like the work, the effort, the knowledge, it's all of that being reduced into this like, well, it's just a craft. But if you look at like master carpenters, that's technically like a craft,
right?
Like craftspeople, that's like a recognized, like you recognize them as a skilled individual in that quote unquote craft.
Yeah.
But because it's typically men doing carpentry or trying to think, or like fine metalworking or something like that, those are technically crafts, but because it's a lot of men doing it, it's more of a, I don't know, it gets more recognition than like the handcrafts that take like as much, if not more, knowledge and skill and practice than any of the other things do.
Yeah.
But because women do it, it's just like,
and you can't even argue that, like, well, but it's because it's practical rather than decorative, because it's like, well, knitting is very practical because you're literally creating clothing. So it's
right. And but like, you know, a fine carpenter can make, you know, a functional table or, you know, a cabinet, you know, a functional cabinet or, you know, whatever these things are. And, you know, a really nice, you know, carpentry piece is a piece of art. It is also 100%. Done by a craftsperson.
Yeah.
And so I like the term like textile artisan, as a blanket term for like a crafter, because I think it adds, you know, authority back into, or like it claims authority over the work that you put in.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. So I'm trying to reclaim craft as a serious terminology. So if we can come from both sides.
Okay. Well, no, I'm happy to, you know, push for craft.
But artisan is also, yeah.
Yeah, I think artisan kind of, it's not quite like, because like, it's hard to say that like a pattern that I knit for a sweater that I didn't design, like, I don't know that I would call that art necessarily. Like there are sweaters that I've seen that are definitely art, and I'll send you one and we can include it in the show notes. But it's like, I mean, it's like a whole little landscape that's knitted into this sweater, and it's just absolutely stunning. My sister wants to make one, and I was like, I cannot imagine doing that. And so like that to me is art. But then, you know, the sweater that I started last week, I'm like, I don't know. It's just a sweater. It's a,
it's practical.
It's a piece of thing. But like, I also consider myself an artist. Am I a practicing artist? Not necessarily, but I don't know. It's hard to, I don't know. It's just hard to label. And
well, this is the thing. And we've talked about, I've talked about this many times on this podcast, the issue of labels. And I'm always very strict about that when I'm teaching as well. And all those kinds of things. It's like, we have to have labels. We have to have categories for the purposes of international communication and collaboration, because you have to know what everyone's talking about. At the same time, these labels and these categories are extremely limiting and extremely biased, and it's important to be aware of that, I think. So
Well, and then like I feel like in the UK, in like the US, we don't really talk about like intangible cultural heritage as much, but I do a lot of work with Korean cultural heritage and intangible cultural heritage, and they have like handcraft designations as intangible cultural heritage, so they are like recognized by UNESCO as a heritage practice. And so like I would argue that knitting is a heritage practice, maybe not for any particular region, but as like a human practice, it is, you know, it's this passed down ability, it's the skill. So I think 100%. You know, getting more, again, getting more academic with it. We got to make craft academic,
to show that it can be. But also but also, as you say, as you said before, like if people are crafting, artisaning or whatever, not to look down on it just because it's for fun as well. Like it is still a very highly skilled technique and a very highly skilled technology.
Well, and then like just like in our modern society, we're always looking at like, I have ADHD, there's a lot of people with neurodivergence, and so like fidget toys have come on the market, and all of these like ways to adapt to what is considered like normal behavior, right? And so it turns out that a lot of these granny hobbies, again, craft skills, actually do the same thing fidget toys do, but they also like knitting, I was reading somewhere, acts as a natural antidepressant and as like anti-anxiety practice. And so like
not when I do it, but I'm sure but, people like, do it well.
It's like it's the repetitive motion, so crochet, embroidery, whatever, and because you're paying attention to something else
and you see, you know, you physically see progress, which I think is important as well.
Yeah. Like, so you get the like dopamine hit of like finishing something, of accomplishing something. I finished
even
a row.
It's just a row. Yeah, exactly.
And like I used to occasionally knit during some of my university classes because like it'd be at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and that's when I want to take a nap. But I'm like, this is nothing against you.
Well, you know, but actually, there's a lot of people. That was interesting, actually, in this conference where I went to York, where I saw the mouse door that we talked about last episode, I think. We did a session, I ran a session on experimental archaeology, and there were a couple of people in the audience knitting or crocheting, like when they did it. And I really like that. Like, that's also, you see that quite a lot, especially in conferences that are more focused on materials or on experiments or practical skills. You know, a lot of the academics are also actively involved in the crafts themselves, and they actually just will be making something while listening. They're paying attention and they're, you know, interacting and discussing, but they also are just doing some knitting. I mean, it's what you were talking about last episode with your different levels of concentration requirement, you know, like how much
exactly. Well, and like arguably if I have knitting in my hands, I'm going to pay attention to whatever it is like 10 times better than if I didn't, because otherwise I'd be like fidgeting. I'd be looking around the room. I'd be, you know, like my brain would be off somewhere. Like,
yes, 100%.
But if my hands are busy.
I used to always revise for exams at university while having something on in the background. And mm-hmm. I wasn't even necessarily paying attention to the thing in the background, but just having that, usually some sort of comedy show, because all the laughter track was, you know, quite nice to listen to.
Yeah, it just sort of blends together.
Yeah. And it's sort of funny because if I'm actively writing, then I can't have something on. I need to be like concentrating and I need to have like word-free music or something going on in the background. But if I'm mm-hmm. trying to remember stuff and trying to focus on stuff to think about, then I can, yeah, it's a funny thing, which is probably similar.
It's almost like there's like, I imagine there's like little goblins in my brain and they want to distract me.
They need
me.
To keep, be keep,
so I
kept
have to like entertain the little goblins so that I can pay attention.
Yeah, that's nice. On that note, let's take a very quick tea break, top up our tea. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope your teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So, I mean, honestly, we could probably do another episode about this and just chat about the difference between art and craft and technologies and all this kind of thing, because I find that absolutely fascinating. But maybe we can just end the episode with a little bit more of a kind of back to your personal experience with knitting. First of all, I forgot to ask you, I meant to ask you in the last episode, what your favorite fun fact was about knitting, or if you have a fun fact.
So I do have a fun fact. I only learned it sort of, well, I kind of knew it, but then forgot it and then relearned it recently. But apparently in World War II, resistance fighters would knit code into knit garments to get them across enemy lines. So they would like knit Morse code into the pattern of the knitting.
That is very cool. That is
Isn't
a good
that cool?
Fact.
Apparently there's like a fiction book called, I forget what it's called, and I will put it in the show notes. But anyway, I've heard it's good. I have not read it, but apparently it's about resistance knitting. And I was like, yeah, sign me up. Spies, knitting, let's
I
go.
I like that, resistance knitting. Yeah. That's like the whole yarn bombing and stuff as well, right? Mm-hmm. Where people will do things. A slightly more fun version is in my parents' town at Christmas, they'll knit tops for all of the post boxes and stuff so that they have like little seams, little knitted seams on the top. It's so
cute.
Oh my
god, that's so cute.
Very, very cute. I love those kinds of things. Like public knitting displays, I think are just so cute. It's
Well, and then there's Knitting in Public Day, which is I think June 14th or something like that. Somewhere in June, there's a Knit in Public Day. So you take your knitting outside and knit.
Oh, we should have timed this episode to be released with that.
I know. We had the perfect opportunity. No.
Maybe we can do a live
knit along. We'll have the next
follow-up. Yeah, there we go.
There we go.
To give an update on our experimental research project.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. We'll do that. But that's like, have you ever participated in one of those? They have a thing in a local town to me where it's like knitting cinema. So
I've heard of them.
Yeah, which sounds really fun. So I'm kind of tempted to go along with my crochet and
do it. Usually, like here, it's like crafting night or something at local cinemas. I happen to know one of the cinema owners nearby, and then a different cinema nearby, the owner comes and knits, it turns out, and I didn't know that. But I was like, I'd love to like get that started. And the problem is that a lot of knitters are like, we'll show up to knit night at the yarn shop, but then trying to get them anywhere else is nearly impossible. It's because no one really wants to take initiative and no one wants to like make the plan or book the space,
the classic
or whatever.
Group planning problems.
We're happy to show up at the designated location at the designated time. And then that's it. I've not gone mostly because no one's planned it and I don't want to plan it. I'm not a planner. So
that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah. But it sounds cool either way.
It does sound fun. I think I might give it a shot. I'll let people know how it goes if I decide to join it. But so I feel like since we've been talking a lot about knitting and about the crafts and all that kind of thing, I mean, I have tried knitting many times. Maybe the next time you come over, we'll try again and you can see if you can actually ignite the passion in me. But if people are trying to get into sewing, there's me, Freudian slip. I refuse to try knitting. I want to sew.
Your Freudian slip is showing.
Well, if anyone wants to start knitting, this episode is about knitting, Matilda. What would you kind of suggest as a good way to start? Like, what's the best way to get into knitting?
Well, I think it depends on what kind of learner you are. Mm. So I talked about, you know, observing somebody knitting continental and teaching myself that way. That works for me. So watching somebody, I can do it. Mm. I work better in a classroom setting because there's like a sense of accountability. Whereas if I teach myself something, I don't have the follow through. I'm not good at it. So, you know, I would be better going to somebody and saying, can you teach me to knit? And that would be just work out better for me because I get to watch them and there's like a bit of accountability there. But a ton of knitters that I've like met recently who have also learned recently just use YouTube. I mean, it's a free resource.
That's what I
There's yeah. so many videos on how to knit from yeah. different people. So you can pick different speeds, different people's voices. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
And then the materials themselves are fairly accessible and affordable. You can even go to like secondhand shops and get needles and mm-hmm. yarn even, mm-hmm. or, you know, the resale sites. I was seeing yarn on Poshmark the other day. Oh. I know. And Ravelry, you can buy through Ravelry. People list their stashes for sale. And so you can buy yarn through them. Or just like me, I just collect yarn wherever I go. And so it doesn't really matter where it comes from. But yeah, so I think if you can self-study, it's a really accessible craft. But, you know, if you can get to somebody in person at your local yarn shop and say, hey, I want to learn how to knit, who do I ask? They'll set you up. It probably won't be free. I think people should be paid for their time and knowledge, but mm-hmm. some places have like a pay as you go scale. And I really like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or it like is. Pay what you can, or.
Yeah. Or maybe like pay in kind, right? Like, so you can.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would love to do a Skillshare.
Yeah.
Kind
yeah.
of.
That's a good fun
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea. And what would you, because like, there's all sorts of things. You look them up and there's, for example, with crochet, I've realized that there's like so many things that now that I've done it for a little, even just for a little bit, I am already realizing like, oh, okay, this wool is terrible. Or like, this hook is definitely not the right kind. I need one with this kind of handle. And like all this sort of thing. Is there anything that you wish you'd known when you kind of first started knitting that you think would be like a good tip for beginner knitters to be aware of?
Well, because I learned when I was so young and
true.
I like, no. I mean, knitting as like a,
be nappy
as an industry
first.
Craft like an industrialized craft, as in like it's been capitalized.
Yeah,
the technology has expanded in such a crazy way. So like, yes, there were circular knitters like circular knitting needles before I started, mm-hmm. but I didn't learn about them until much later,
right? Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so I mean, just being familiar with the current technology of knitting is a big deal. So like one of the knitters that I occasionally see, I mean, she's been knitting since a very long time. And so she's not really familiar with the new technologies because she just never needed to know it. Whereas like the current knitters are like using the new patterns and the new terminology and the new like knitting needles and all of the like better yarns or, you know, whatever it is. So it's hard to say like what I wish I had known because I didn't know it. And it didn't matter to me.
Yeah. Okay. So sort of maybe though people could, do you think it's good to like do research beforehand then and like know all the options, or do you think it's better to just go like straight into it and learn as you go?
So I have two minds. So like, yes, you need to learn like the basic stitches, like, you know, in crochet, it's single crochet is kind of like the standard start as far as more.
That's what I can do.
That is also what I can do. And that's about it. I don't ask questions after that. But like with knitting, that gets really boring really fast. And that holds up a lot of people. So like my sister, I mean, she's incredible. She's a designer, seamstress. She's extraordinaire.
She made my wedding dress.
She did indeed. And it was beautiful.
Yeah.
But she didn't get started in knitting until like 15 years ago or something. And because she kept trying it and going, oh, it's so boring, and like giving up immediately.
That's my problem as well. Yeah, actually.
So then she found a beautiful cardigan with like cables and lace, and it was super intricate and like just stunning and very much her style.
Yeah.
And immediately figured it out like perfectly, like no issues at all. Like, like it was just unfair, really. She still outknits me, and I'm like, this is not fair. Come on. Certainly I can do one thing. No, she's just incredible. But yeah, I think knitting something that you're excited about and you want to wear or possess, I think is a crucial thing.
Yeah.
Because you will get bored if it's just like
for the
a plain,
yeah,
like garter stitch scarf or something.
Right.
Like you will lose your mind. So even I run into projects where I'm just like, oh, it's so boring. Why am I doing this?
So don't be afraid to go a bit harder than you think then at the beginning.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely challenge yourself. And like, I mean, a big thing is like, if you go to your local yarn shop, you will find a crafting community of one variety or the other. And there's such a resource there that I think a lot of people don't use because they just don't hang out there. Yeah. But it's an excellent third space. And so you can just like make new friends and talk about things that you're running into issues with, or so like, how do you do this technique? How do you do this technique? Like something that's been coming up a lot is German short rows, which is like knitting a very like short
it's a short row, and then you turn around and you knit again. And so you can like expand different sections of your knitting without knitting the whole thing.
I love how the way by you that quote was just great. One of the things that's coming up a lot is German short rows. And you just said it as in like,
in the last month or two, like I've knit several people short rows because they just didn't want to deal with them because you have to keep track of them. And like, there's a lot of counting. You have to be able to read your knitting to do them well. Right. And so they're just like, can you just do them for me? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I can. And then... yeah. And so it's come up a lot. And so people have been asking me a lot about it. They're like, oh, I have to do short rows. I don't know how. And I'm like, cool, let's go over it. Let's, talk about it. But it's because I'm there at this, in this space as part of this community, offering my knowledge and expertise to people who don't have it. So, make use of the people around you.
Which also, I mean, I think that goes for so many different crafts, right? I mean, there's so much, like you said, things like YouTube and other, I mean, obviously other videoing skill sharing platforms exist, but like, that's how I've learned all my things. Cause I'm definitely a very visual learner. Like I need to be shown the steps. I'm really bad at following patterns. Cause I'm like, I don't understand, why has it got all these numbers in it? And it's like just confusing to me. Whereas if I sit down with someone and do it, then it's so much better. And I think that's in so many cases, and that's why it is important to value these skills and value these kind of technological traditions, because that's how we have learned for hundreds of thousands, probably millions of years. Like it's how we've learned.
Yeah, exactly.
Is by having this shared community. And I think that almost shows how things like crafting and things like learning these different traditions is one of the important things that makes us human, which is probably a very long take on that, but like,
I mean, we can have a whole podcast episode about that,
but right, let's do that
next one. But I totally agree. And I think it speaks to how much skill and practice is involved in these crafts and how easy it would be to lose them if you weren't practicing them.
Yes.
And if you weren't talking about them.
Yeah.
Because there's a ton of knitters that I meet who have never knit a sweater because they seem scary or big or something, putting in some way. And so, but if you can knit a scarf, you can knit a sweater. Like, honestly, it is not.
Big statement.
Big statement. It's going to be controversial. I promise you, if you can knit and purl, you can make a sweater. Will it fit you well? Maybe not. But
well, it could. Probably not.
But with very little extra skills, you can knit a sweater. Yeah. And so, having somebody to tell you that is really important.
Yeah.
Because like a lot of new knitters are like, oh no, I couldn't possibly. Yeah. And it's like, no, you can.
You need the...
What do you mean you can't?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The confidence for the community. Exactly. The support. Yeah. Which I think, especially since, for example, COVID, I think is something that a lot of people missed, and it's kind of almost gotten a little lost a little bit sometimes. And I feel like people are only just rediscovering like the importance of community in that way, because everyone got so used to doing stuff online or doing stuff. And now it's kind of getting back a little bit more to like meeting new people and discovering new hobbies or new things. And it's been a different way of socializing, which is interesting to observe.
Well, and I think with the pandemic, with the pandemic, everything going online, is that people are realizing like, oh yeah, I need to go be part of community because the internet isn't necessarily doing it for me. Whereas social media makes things like so accessible, and you can be part of any number of groups about various and sundry things. But there's something really special about finding your like group of people.
Yeah.
And like going to do a thing with your group of people.
Yeah.
So I think
the fallibility of like technology, like, do you remember when at some point there was like a whole shutdown of Meta or something just for like a day or two? But suddenly all of these like small businesses who rely on the community that they've built up on Instagram or something realize like, oh shoot, like, this is gonna not only affect my like sociability, but also my actual business. And then so many people discovered like, oh gosh, I have this great community on Instagram and stuff, but what if it did just vanish? Like how would I find people again, and how would that work? So physical, there's definitely something to say for physical encounters.
Exactly. And like pre-internet, pre, technology that we have. Like I've been watching a couple like shows about like the home front during World War II. Like, I don't know if you ever saw Home Fires, but no. Like there was such a push for like, I mean, the community already existed in like, let's say a small English village, you yes. know, but yeah, yeah. because, you know, all the men folk were out fighting, the women really banded together to do like community
right.
work.
Yeah.
And
to keep up
make jam or yeah. And like it wasn't like, to me, I think it's not necessarily like the war effort that is interesting. It's the like deliberate community building and the commute, like the community work. And so like
yeah,
they would get together and like knit together. Yeah.
And indeed or, it's always linked by craft in some way, some sort of
yeah, or like creating.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
gardening or making jam or yeah. Yeah. you know, insert like the traditional like home craft, you know, yes. like for those yeah. like home tasks,
yeah.
but doing them as a group. And I think with technology we've lost that, and I think that's really
yeah.
sad.
Yeah, definitely. Which, you know I am aware how ironic that is that we're discussing this on a digital podcast
but,
based in different continents talking about this.
I mean, we are spoiled because we do yeah. have this like ability to connect
yes.
virtually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But also don't forget to do it in person.
Yeah.
I guess is
yeah.
the and, my ultimate feeling about this.
And remember, like, that physical technologies and crafts are also great ways to connect, not just with our existing community, but also with past communities. And yeah.
Yeah. Also, like, just go ask people, you know, like I was talking about, you know, if you want to go to a museum and know what a conservator right. has done at yeah, that museum, just yeah. ask. I mean, me as a conservator, if somebody from like who is not in the museum field at all and was just curious about it, emailed me and was like, oh, could you give me a tour of like all the things you've worked on at this museum? Oh, my gosh, I'd love it. I offer it all the time.
Yeah.
I don't even work for the museum anymore. And I'm like, yeah, I'll give you a tour anytime.
I mean, gosh, if I could do that in person, it would be great. But I just do that online because I can't do it in person. But yeah, and I also love telling people about stuff. That's the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize about us as sort of archaeologists, Egyptologists, anthropologists. We really love talking about the research and stuff that we're doing and the work we're doing.
Which is why we go over time every
yes, and that's why this is a long episode. On which note, I feel we may have come to the end of this particular tea break. But yeah, before we get back to our, well, I was going to say back to work, but let's face it, we'll probably go and do some crafting after this.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm trying to finish a sweater in a week, and that today is my last day. So.
Oh, okay. Oh, well then, I better let you go indeed. Do you have any kind of, I don't know, exciting events coming up? If people want to learn more about what you're doing, either with knitting or with your conservation work or anything else, how can they find you?
So they can look at my website. That's for conservation. It's vandamconservation.com. And my email is listed there. So if you have any questions about conservation knitting, feel free to use that. I don't post a ton about conservation or knitting on my Instagram. I don't do a lot there, but it's Dutch Jess with three S's for Jess. So you're welcome to follow me if you'd like occasionally. I've been posting about the sweater I've been knitting because it has gone remarkably fast. And usually I don't finish a sweater in a week, but I'm so close. I'm finishing the sleeves. So I'm optimistic about my odds. But if you're in the New England area and you want to come knit with me, please reach out any way you want to. I knit at the Nitty Gritty Yarn Shop in Peterborough. So come join us. We're a lovely group. And yeah.
Great. No, well, yeah. Thank you so much for coming to chat to me about, I mean, we have so many other topics that we can chat about. I'm sure I'll have you on again at some point and we can have more chats about crafting, but it was lovely as ever to have you on. So thank you.
Well, it's been a joy to be back. So can't wait for the next one.
And I hope that all of you listening also enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, please get in touch. Sometimes when podcasting, it's sort of like talking into the void because it's not very interactive with the audience unless the audience actually gets in touch. So I always love hearing from people. So you can find all of my contact information and all of Jess's contact information in the show notes. So please do go check that out and get in touch and say hi. As we were talking about, community is important. So it's always nice.
Yeah. Tell us what we should talk about next time.
Yeah. There you go. There we go. If I want Jess back on again, what should we talk about? Give us a random topic and we'll just rant and vent about it for a good solid hour.
That would be fantastic. I'm ready.
If you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode or about Jess's work, as I say, you can find all of the contact information as well as all of the links to things we've discussed in the show notes.
Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.